Hi, this is Lars Christensen. This is number 0149 of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0149. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Hollywood casting director Paul Weber talks about the art of casting. It's just as important to find the right actor when casting even the smallest role.
Casting the smaller supporting roles is such an important part of any film or television show, and can make or break the TV episode or show. I think that when I first started casting, my boss made that really clear when we'd cast a couple of one-line or two-line actors that just stood out like sore thumbs in the piece. And that was my first casting job, and it was a big wake-up call to me that those actors have to be really carefully cast.
We have another retro interview with an actor no longer with us, the late Bob Denver, best known as Gilligan from Gilligan's Island. Did Bob know how big of a hit that show would become over the years?
No, I would have made a better deal, Peter. I would have made some kind of a deal. It's been on the air continually for 30 years, and it's been really fun to watch the audience because it's been the same every year, pretty much the same, except in the mid-80s, the older folks in their 70s and 80s started taking the autographed pictures home for themselves.
No, that's for me. It's not for my grandson.
Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and on Book Banter, we take an inside look at NBC's must-see TV glory years with Top of the Rock. This review will be brought to you in living color on the Stuff File program.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0149, was Lars Christensen, the assistant program director at CyberStationUSA.com. And, you know, you can hear this program on CyberStationUSA.com. Plus, a lot of the CyberStationUSA.com shows can also be heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, like the Stuff File. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. And thank you very much, Lars, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, much to the surprise of the manager who dreamed up the campy promotion, hundreds of naked shoppers flocked to a new German supermarket offering free groceries to the first 100 customers willing to shop in the nude. They actually camped outside the new Priss supermarket in the hopes of being among the lucky first 100 promised $250 worth of groceries. Customers wandered between the aisles studying shopping lists in nothing but their birthday suits. Store manager Niles Sterndorf was overwhelmed by the success of his gimmick, saying, "I never thought 100 people would come. I thought maybe more like 10. But police said about 250 people turned up, so many that they were allowed in only in batches of 20 to avoid a crush. Is anybody at all concerned about the possible hygiene problem here? I mean, naked people running through a supermarket? Remind me to stay away from their produce section. Yeesh. And one of the actors who played an Ewok in Star Wars Return of the Jedi is in trouble for, well, basically flashing his Ewok at a college student on a train headed for Manchester, England. Actor Nicholas Reed, who is a dwarf, is now facing jail time after he admitted to showing the student his manhood. Unfortunately, this is the second time Reed has gotten into trouble for flashing a woman on a train, and this latest incident violates his suspended sentence for his 2010 offense. So, he could go to jail this time. The judge in the case denied a request by Reed's defense attorney for a psychiatric report on her client. Thomas said there is very little evidence of mental illness in his case. Along with his Ewok role, Reed's film credits include playing a goblin in Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone and part of the Goblin Corps in Labyrinth. Yes, a little man with some big trouble. Elsewhere, after allegedly wrecking her car and leaving her three children ages 5, 12, and 16 alone inside, Houston police said they found 34-year-old Stephanie Dillard inside a drugstore, naked and eating ice cream. Boy, she should have been shopping at that store in Germany. Anyway, they claim her children were in the car with her when her vehicle collided with a metro bus. All of the children were shaken up and suffered minor injuries. The 5-year-old reportedly had a large gash over one eye. Detectives said that after the wreck, Dillard got out of the car and walked away, leaving her children alone at the scene. She then allegedly went to a nearby CVS store and began taking off her clothes as she ate ice cream. Investigators said Dillard put up a fight when officers tried to arrest her. The children have been turned over to a grandmother. Police say they have not figured out what caused Dillard's strange behavior. Really? Really? Nothing like maybe alcohol or drugs? You're telling me she was completely clean? Doubt it. Doubt it highly. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, some might say the destruction by lightning of a 51-foot-tall statue of Jesus that stood along Interstate 75 in Monroe, Ohio, might have been a sign from above. But the Solid Rock Church isn't holding the Almighty responsible for this one. They plan to have the statue replaced by late July. The previous statue, destroyed 2 years ago, depicted Jesus from the waist up with arms uplifted, drawing the nickname Touchdown Jesus, or Big Butter Jesus for its creamy color. The new version will be a full-bodied Jesus with arms reaching out as if beckoning. It is being constructed with fire-resistant material, you know, to ward off those pesky lightning bolts. Ah, yes, the Lord works in mysterious ways. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? On a movie or TV set, before the director directs, before the shots are blocked, before the actors remember their lines, the roles actually have to be cast. So what is that process like? On the line with us right now is Hollywood casting director Paul Weber. He joins us from Los Angeles. Hi, Paul.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on the program. So I want to talk about not necessarily the casting of major stars in films, because a lot of times I think actors come to roles because of what they've done in the past and what they're known for. But I want to talk about some of those smaller roles. When you work as a casting director and you have to cast the lead's best friend or mother or other characters or a doorman, what do you look for in an actor, and what do you see when somebody comes to you?
Well, casting the smaller supporting roles is such an important part of any film or television show, and it can make or break the TV episode or show. I think when I first started casting, my boss made that really clear when we'd cast a couple of one-line or two-line actors that just stood out like sore thumbs in the piece. And that was my first casting job, and it was a big wake-up call to me that those actors have to be really carefully cast. And they're there to support the leading actors and to make an impression without without taking over the scene in a way that makes them think that they're playing Hamlet instead of, let's say, the doorman. So you need someone who understands the role, who has a certain look, a certain quality when they walk in the room, when they deliver the line in a natural way that feels completely authentic, and visually what the producers are looking for, or they identify with a role in a way that makes us feel like, yeah, this guy or this girl could play this particular role. And it's just a little drop color on the palette of the piece that just makes a slight impression without overwhelming the scene.
So do you believe in that old adage, there are no small parts, just small actors?
I think I actually really do agree with that. I think it's a real craft to come in and sort of hit that mark just gently enough. You don't have time to really develop an arc of a character like a guest lead would or lead in a movie. You have to come in there and just be available for a slight adjustment, maybe do the line a couple of different ways, be flexible, be accessible, be friendly in the room. Make yourself available to the director or the producer in a way that they feel like this is an actor or an actress we'd be happy to have on the set without any attitude, without any ego, comes in and does their job and goes on to the next one. So I think it's really important that actors understand that process and how important it is to win those kinds of roles in a way that the producers and directors will respond to favorably.
You can be outside of a casting office at a casting call for a particular role, especially if it's a period piece. For instance, looking for the next Fonzie, for instance. And you will look outside and you'll see a whole bunch of actors dress the part, sounding like the part, and you'll see a whole bunch of other actors who are there who are just with the lines and nothing else. What does your eye go to when somebody comes in for a role, whether they can remember the lines, whether they can convey the lines, or whether they actually go that extra step and look the part, or is that a hindrance sometimes?
Well, that's a great question. I've had cops to read for cop roles, and they've come in dressed like police officers, yet they can't act like a police officer at all. They're not convincing because they haven't really learned the craft of auditioning or the craft of acting enough to be able to make it sound completely authentic and natural, strangely enough. So I really prefer that actors not come in dressed as the role, give the casting director a little bit of credit that we have an imagination to imagine what you would look like in a uniform or a doctor's smock. We know that this is an audition. This is not on set. You don't have wardrobe there. You don't have makeup there. What we're able to see past all of that and see if an actor can come in and naturally identify in an interesting way with a small role, that's what we look for. And the camouflage of a uniform doesn't replace talent that may or may not be there. So I would dress to suggest, but not dress as if you've already got the part.
You mentioned the craft of acting and the craft of auditioning. Are they literally two different crafts? And I'm wondering if a lot of young actors know if there is a difference between the two.
I'm not sure if actors really understand there is such a difference between coming in and auditioning well and being a good actor. A good actor not function very well, and seeing relatively mediocre actors roll in the room because they know how to win the role in the room. And that's a craft that I think actors need to work on, and it's actually what I teach when I travel and teach auditioning workshops. Ideally, it would be great for actors to be able to do both, audition well and really be good actors. And yes, they are out there, and there are many, many out there, which is why it's such a competitive business. However, that would be, for me, the ultimate, is an actor who understands that auditioning is a special skill that is layered on top of the foundation of learning how to be a good actor.
Okay, so as you just described, if there are actors out there who are better in the final product, in the final scene, when they have the role than when they're auditioning, and conversely, if there are actors who are actually better auditioning than when they're in the final scene, does that make your job as a casting director that much more difficult?
Well, it does. Sometimes, I tell you what, when you're working with, especially in television moves so quickly that directors really want to see an actor who can deliver a performance in the audition room, because they don't have a lot of time to work with actors aside from maybe blocking them out and making their day and making their budget. So I see it time and time again that the actor comes in with a performance with a small fee, because you don't have your wardrobe, you don't have your makeup, you're in an audition room. But you need to be able to see that performance, because in other words, you need to be camera ready when you audition, so that the director doesn't have a lot of time to spend with you, because he won't be able to spend a lot of time with you directing you in the scene, most likely.
Do you have to have a somewhat of a photographic memory? And by that I mean, have you ever been in a situation where you audition for, you have someone who auditions in front of you for a particular role, and they're not right, and you say thank you very much, and they move on, and then somewhere down the road you have another project you're working on, and you think, oh, that person who wasn't right for X, suddenly I think they might be perfect for Y.
All the time, Peter, all the time. And that happens a great deal of the time. Let's say 100 actors come in to audition for a role, and, let's make it 10 so it's not so daunting. But let's say 10 come in to audition for a role. 5 to 6 of those are relatively forgettable. They just don't leave an impression one way or the other. 2 or 3 are really good actors. But both of those are going to be brought back because the other actor just isn't right for that role. Well, that actor I remember to make a note of and bring back for something else down the line. And I make notes like that all the time. And we also put people on tape. We have them, there's a digital, you know, record, an imprint of their audition that we keep on file so that I can go back to old projects and say, remember that guy who came into audition for such and such? He wasn't right for that part, but he'd be great for this other project. And sometimes I send that directly to a director or producer and say, listen, this actor would be great for this, and he's not in town, or we can try to bring him in if you'd like, but he's available, and he would be in this role. What do you think of him? And they could look at an audition from a different project and decide, and it's happened before, that they would hire him right off the tape.
How much easier or how much more difficult has modern technology played a role in what you do? Nowadays, people can tape themselves with their iPhones. Everyone's got a video camera. People have a YouTube page, a website. The list goes on and on. Does that make it easier for you, or has it become white noise with everybody's out there on everything?
Both. And I guess it's the way you manage all of that noise out there. I think the more effectively you find a way to manage it, I'm still maneuvering my way around all of that. I could spend all day on the computer looking at some tapes of actors. You know, we tend to move very quickly through that process. We try to be subjective or objective as we can when we're looking at actors. We do make opinions very quickly. We need to. There isn't a lot of time, but digital universe that's opened up to actors now makes it much more possible for them to get in front of us in a way that they never used to before. And I think that's a good thing. I think just how you manage your time so that you can get through all of those auditions as quickly as possible, make your mind up about who you want to present to the director or producer, bring back for them. And it's a lot easier in so many ways than it used to be. And a lot more, much better for actors in terms of their access to us.
It's a very interesting topic indeed, a very interesting craft that you have, a talent as a casting director. I urge everyone out there when they're watching television and movies, read all the credits to the end, because all the people you see there are very important, including the casting director. Paul, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thanks so much, Peter. And once in a while, we even get front credits, you know, so look for that, too.
Casting director Paul Weber. You can check out Paul's website by going to paulwebercasting.com. You can also go to my website, thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0149, and you'll find links to Paul's site. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Coming up in just a matter of moments, a very special retro interview with the late Bob Denver, the man we all knew well as Gilligan.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey. Your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that puts a smile on your face and a skip in your step. Please avoid skipping if you are driving.
And still to come on the program, Stuart Nolman with another edition of Book Banter. Plus, of course, there is an idiot of the day. And in just a few moments, another retro interview with an actor no longer with us, this time around Gilligan himself, the late Bob Denver. But first, more Stuff File news right here for your listening pleasure. 23-year-old Priscilla Dang was jogging in her Vancouver, Washington neighborhood when two teenagers on bikes, one 16, the other 18, approached her from behind. Priscilla said, "One went in front and made eye contact with me like a smirk, like I thought he was saying hi. The next thing I knew, I was pretty much groped on my bottom." Well, unfortunately for the alleged teen gropers, Priscilla has taken kung fu lessons since she was 5, and her family actually owns a martial arts studio. In an instant, she had one of the teenagers on the ground and made him apologize. When the second teenager called her a derogatory term, Dang says she just snapped, hitting him in the face several times while simultaneously dodging his lame punches. And when he pulled out a knife, she used his own bike as a shield until a passerby showed up and called 911. Both suspects fled but were later apprehended by sheriff's deputies. Dang said, "I think they knew they messed with the wrong girl." Wow. Dang, boy, you got schooled by Dang. And in Leicester, England, Tim Price is so fed up with telemarketers that he's taken some extra measures he hopes will put an end to his problem. He's legally added 9 P's to the front of his last name. So his last name is still Price. It's just spelled with 9 extra P's. Tim explains, "My theory is that when these salesmen see my name on their list of names to call, they'll think, oh, blow it, I can't even pronounce his name, so I won't call him." Meanwhile, he now calls himself Tim 10P Price. Tim said, "I've just got my driver's license and passport back. I'm looking forward to the next time I go abroad. It should raise a few eyebrows going through customs." Yeah, because that's what you want to do going through customs. Raise eyebrows. Wow. I'm Peter Anthony Holder. This is the Stuff File program. Let's go back in time.
This is the Stuff File.
It's time for another retro interview with a celebrity that is no longer with us. Over the last 25 years or so, I've had the pleasure to talk with some great stars of the past. This time around, it's a chat I had back in June of 1994. The star was born Robert Osborne Denver, but we knew him best as Bob. We knew him even better as Gilligan on Gilligan's Island. At the time that we spoke, he was promoting his just-released book, Gilligan, Maynard, and Me. Here is just part of that hour-long interview now.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Gilligan.
Sure.
You did that show for only 3 years, correct?
Right, 98 episodes.
98 episodes. I guess you had no idea at the time you were going into this, the phenomenon it would become.
No, I would have made a better deal, Peter. I would have made some kind of a deal. Now, it's 30 years this year. It's been on the air continually for 30 years, and it's been really fun to watch the audience because it's been the same every year, pretty much the same, except the mid-'80s, the older folks in their 70s and 80s started taking the autographed pictures home for themselves. No, that's for me. It's not for my grandson, you know.
Now, when that show first was being cast,
mm-hmm.
you weren't the first choice for Gilligan, were you?
Well, he was looking, I guess he was looking for the Van Dyke brother.
Jerry.
Jerry, yeah. And then when I met with him, I had a meeting with Sherwood Schwartz, the producer, writer, and creator. And when he and I got done talking, I was on the floor laughing when he told me the premises of some of the, you know, and the guest stars and things. I said, are you sure the network's going to let you do this? And he said, yeah, I've got permission to shoot the pilot. And so I said, well, you know, fine. You know, it'd be great. You know, so we shook hands, and that was the deal. And then we shot the pilot on the island of Kauai in, you know, the Hawaiian string there. And I still couldn't believe it when I was in Hawaii for 2 weeks shooting a half-hour situation comedy that was so stupid and silly. And then I figured, well, if it didn't sell, at least I got a nice, you know, 2 weeks, and I stayed an extra 2 weeks after, so I had a month on the island. And I figured that was really nice. You know, if it didn't sell, fine. Then, of course, it sold and became a hit.
Now, in the long run, you, along with all the other cast members, have been, well, typecast in the roles you played.
Right.
But ironically, wasn't one of the reasons Mr. Schwartz didn't want you initially because he thought you were typecast as Maynard?
Yeah, he couldn't. I said to him, there was this guy named Bob Denver that did a beatnik on Dobie Gillis, and he said he did a beatnik. Well, I'm not looking for that kind of character. I'm looking for, you know, a kind of a, you know, stumbling, you know, innocent type. And so after we met and had our meeting, he said, you know, we talked for about an hour, and we just got along really good. And I guess our favorite book was Robinson Crusoe as kids, both of us, you know. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot in common.
Now, you yourself just said a few minutes ago it was a rather silly premise.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of weeks ago, we were talking on the air here with Steve Allen.
Right.
And we talked about various television shows, and he wasn't too flattering with your show or the Beverly Hillbillies. And it was, those are shows that, critically speaking, were not necessarily beloved in the press.
Oh, no.
Yet the audiences seemed to just fall over themselves watching them.
Yeah. It's interesting because the critics just killed our show. I mean, I think out of, you know, 100... reviews, there were, you know, 99 bad and one good one. But it was, you know, it didn't bother us because we knew we were doing really something silly and something very, very broad, you know, a lot of physical comedy, and with a premise I thought was just really hilarious. And then I had a cast that was excellent. You know, I mean, each person was, you know, perfect as the character. And, you know, what's happened is it picks up kids every year. Mm-hmm. You know, I get letters. Just last week I got one from a mother who says, the one-year-old's watching in the high chair. Please send an autographed picture. So, you know, here it is, 94, and you know, it just rolls on. I mean, I understand why a lot of the intellectuals or the elite don't, you know, really get behind it, because it's, you know, it's that kind of comedy that, you know, it's, you can put it down really easy.
When you did shoot the pilot and you looked at the script for the first time, did you think it would sell?
You know, I had no idea. I just, you know, it was so much fun to do that kind of, you know,
because I understand.
Plus I met Alan Hale, yeah. You know, and doing physical comedy with Alan was probably the most fun.
Didn't Natalie Schaefer played Lovey Howell only take the pilot because she wanted to go to Hawaii?
That's right. Yeah, her story was that she was in Acapulco or Puerto Vallarta, one of those cities in Mexico, on a vacation. And at the time, her mother was ill in Los Angeles, and a telegram came to her table at dinner, and she read it and burst into tears. And all her friends with her on the vacation said, oh, Natalie, is it your mother? Is something wrong? She said, no, the pilot sold. See, and she was one of her favorite stories. I mean, she had, they kind of almost convinced her it wouldn't sell. You know, mm-hmm. It was just a vacation for her. And after we started shooting, she really got into it. But she was really a great lady.
Now, one of the shows that I was a big fan of was The Good Guys.
Oh, you're one of my fans. One of my few fans.
Yeah, I watched that. It was on for, what, 2 years?
Yeah.
With Herb Edelman.
Right, and Joyce Van Patten.
Joyce Van Patten. I was looking through some of the credits of some of the things you've done. I have a couple of books here in front of me besides yours, which kind of show television series as they go along.
Yeah.
And when you think about it, you had a pretty successful run there. I mean, you went from Dobie Gillis to Gilligan's Island to The Good Guy. You had a decade where you were just busy from one show to another. A lot of actors can't say that.
Yeah, I had about 11 years starting in 59 to 70.
Mm-hmm.
And then I decided that was it. I just said, that's enough. I want to go back to stage work. And so I was on Broadway for about 4 months. Woody Allen's play played Again Sam.
Mm-hmm.
He left and I took over. And then when I took it on the road for about, I guess, almost 6 or 7 years, and then just proceeded to do everything that was available off-Broadway. I came on the circuit, you know, and dinner theater was very hot in this country then, and it was hilarious. People came to see plays. They didn't even know what they were. What do you call that? And I said, it's a play. No kidding. How long has it been around? And I say about 4,000 years. No kidding, you know. But it was really fun for people that would never go to the theater. I mean, they would never, you know, they figured they had to get dressed up or do something. And the wife would drag them and, you know, tell them it's a big buffet and they could eat all they wanted to and then just be quiet during the show. And we did good comedies. We did all the Neil Simons. my wife and I, and so we had a great time.
Do you find in doing a role like Gilligan and the typecasting that you get, and other characters that you have played, let's be honest, some of the characters you played have not been some of the brightest guys.
No. They were leaning toward nebbish. They weren't terribly dumb, but they weren't terribly bright.
I mean, you're an educated guy. You were a political science major?
Yeah, that's right.
And you were also a teacher?
Yes.
Do you find that sometimes people come up to you and they think you are Gilligan?
No, it's really funny because I thought maybe after, in the 70s, something like that would happen. But now it's 30 years and people have been coming up to me. And they know it's just a character I made up. There's nobody that really... It's such a fantasy, the whole show is, For kids, it's like a whole thing in frustration. He never gets off the island. Where'd all those clothes come from? How did he do that? And so it's kind of fun, and they've always been polite. In 30 years, I've had no one come up to me with any kind of rude remark or anything that's weird. They just grin because I'm in their childhood.
Yeah.
The show is stuck in their childhood, and it's a real good memory for them.
Yet I understand, looking through some trivia books, that some people did take it kind of seriously. I understand the U.S. I understand the U.S. Coast Guard got some calls from concerned viewers who suggested that they try and rescue you guys off the island.
It was an admiral in the east here somewhere, and he's a retired admiral, and he was in his 70s, and he got the coordinates. We gave him out one time, the longitude and latitude, which, was, if you looked it up, was in the middle of nowhere in the Pacific Ocean, and he knew the chain of command, so he called Washington, and Washington called Hawaii, and pretty soon they had one of the cutters steaming up, and one of the young sailors came up to the captain and said, "Sir, I think it's a TV show." And he said, "What, son?" He says, "I think it's a TV show, sir." And they checked it out again, and they found out, of course, it was. And they came on the set, the commander did, with this huge stack of, all these memorandums and everything else that came out of Washington. We almost really got rescued.
When I was talking to people in the office and friends of mine telling them that we were going to be talking to you, Bob,
Yeah. Everyone
started singing the song.
You can get 10,000 people together, perfect strangers, and say, "Let's sing something," and somebody says, "Let's sing the theme from Gilligan's Island." And at the end of the song, everybody's friends. You say, "Oh, remember the one where he did? Remember that episode?" And it's really fun to watch.
Can you ever go anywhere without hearing it? Are you tired of that song by now?
No, I don't hear it quite that much. I hear it on interviews and things. And I was in the Pump Room in Chicago with a fancy restaurant there, and they have a little trio playing in the corner, very almost semi-classical, almost chamber music. And as I walked to my table, I heard... Dun, 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 dun. I never heard it quite that version,
There's also a reggae version out there.
There's a rap version, too.
Yeah. After you did such shows as Gilligan, and the concern about being typecast, both by Maynard and by Gilligan, were there any characters that you or your agent thought that you were perfect for and you just didn't get the part?
No, I can't think of any time that, I got where I had a part and I got knocked off because of typecasting. I never got through the initial part of getting the part.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything you see in contemporary television today that you say, "Gee, that'd be a part I'd like to tackle myself"?
Oh, I'd like to be a guest star on Northern Exposure.
Really?
I could play a real crazy character because they certainly have nutty people on that show, and they have dream sequences and all kinds of fantasy. And I like to guest star in that. Last year I did a Evening Shade with Burt Reynolds, and I got to play myself.
Mm-hmm.
I had to go to my acting teacher to figure that out.
Do you watch much television?
Oh, yeah. Sure, I watch Northern Exposure, Home Improvement, and I think I love, Charles Kuro's Sunday Morning.
Mm-hmm.
And my comedy channel, C-SPAN. Some of the routines are a little long, but otherwise it's funny.
The Packwood stuff is good. Is there a place where Gilligan's Island is not seen?
I don't know. Dawn Wells was on a Samoan island that they had to take an outrigger to get to, right? Paddle out to it. And she went into the chief's hut, and the chief's wife went, "Mary Ann!" And she went, "Oh, no." They had no electricity, no TV, and it turned out chief's wife had gone to another island to study nursing and had seen the show there.
What has happened to the cast members?
Well, three of them are gone. The Howells and the skipper, Jim Backus, Natalie Schaefer, and Alan Hale, they passed away. And there's just four of us left now.
And where are you? What are you all doing these days?
Well, Dawn Wells and Russ Johnson, we get together about like two or three times a year, and we get rescued wherever there's a body of water. And it's really fun, because we'll be in an airport, and Dawn will be standing like 10 feet behind me, and some young man in his 20s will come up to me and he'll say, "Well, I really love the show and all that." And I say, "Yeah." And I said, "What do you think of Mary Ann?" He goes, "Oh, wow, she was really great, And I said, "Would you like to meet her someday?" And he goes, "Oh, boy, oh, let me tell you, that would just be, oh, boy." And I say, "There she is." and the guy just turns red, becomes 9 years old right in front of my eyes, can't talk, feet shuffling.
Well, you know, the three women, I think, who were a big hit with a lot of kids, even though they may have been overshadowed by their more glamorous sidekicks, would have to be Betty from Betty and Veronica.
Right.
Betty Rubble.
Yep.
And Mary Ann.
Oh, yeah.
Those are the three.
Over the years, they've had contests wherever I go, you know, and they even had national contests to see who would, you know, who the guys like the most, Ginger or Mary Ann. And Mary Ann always wins like 75 at least percent vote for Mary Ann.
The show you did before, Dobie Gillis.
Right.
You played Maynard Krebs on that show.
Right.
How was it creating that particular character?
Oh, that was fun. He was a beatnik, you know, when he first started out in the first and second year. And nobody knew what a beatnik was except they, you know, really liked music. And I made him a real jazz fan. You know, I mean, Thelonious Monk and Bill Evans and all the big jazz people that were popular at the time. And I was left alone pretty much to create the character because nobody knew exactly, you know, where I was going with it. So it was really a lot of fun. And so it was, you know, for, you know, my first series and my first, you know, acting professional job, you know, it was just a great deal of fun.
During the span of that program, if I'm not mistaken, were you not actually drafted?
Yeah, I was drafted. I had done four episodes, and I got drafted into the Army, actually. And I went down for the physical, and I went 4F because I had a broken neck back in the 50s. And so I went back to the set to tell them. I was so excited, you know, I could, you know, go back and, you know, pick up and do the rest of the first year. And they had signed Michael J. Pollard to take my place as my cousin, a beatnik cousin. And I walked on the set, and they said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm 4F. They don't want me. They don't want me." And they said, "Yeah, funny. When are you going?" I said, "No, really." And they just wouldn't believe me. Until finally, after 3 or 4 hours standing there, they went, Max Schulman came over, and he said, "Are you serious? You didn't get drafted?" And I said, "No." He said, "Just go home. We signed this man here, Michael, for 30 shows. And this is the first one he's doing. Just go home. Please, we'll call you." And then they put me in the next week, and they paid Michael off. He got paid. He did one episode and got paid for 30. And he said, he came out of New York. He said, "I'd heard of going to California to discover gold, but I didn't know it was true until now." You know?
What was it like working with some of the cast members? Warren Beatty was in that show for a while, wasn't he?
He was about 6 or 7 in the first year, but we all knew he wasn't destined for, you know, a situation comedy. He was heading for the motion pictures.
You tell a story about him getting locked in a dressing room?
Oh, yeah, we had one of those little canvas, you know, knockdown dressing rooms on the stage, and somebody locked him in. I don't know who did it. And instead of, you know, yelling to get out or trying to knock it down, he just waited till the cameras rolled and it was during a take. And he started singing an aria in an operatic voice that just carried 2 miles. The director yells, "Cut! What is that? Where is that? Who's doing that?" Then went over and he said, "Warren Beatty's locked in his dressing room." And they said, "Well, let him out. We can't shoot with that kind of noise. Good God."
In addition to a lot of the successes you've had your share of pilots that didn't do well or didn't sell.
Oh, sure.
And the one thing I noticed that's interesting about a lot of the shows you have worked on is that there's an association with Sherwood Schwartz.
Oh, yeah. Sure. But Sherwood, you know, as a producer, he was one of the best, you know, writer-producer. It's amazing. That man was just amazing. We never knew there was any problems when we were shooting. He kept all the network craziness away from us. He was writing scripts literally, you know, 4 months in advance. So, you know, special effects and props always got them in plenty of time. And it was like working on a, you know, you just memorized your words and just went down there and had a great time. It wasn't until afterwards when I left, you know, I realized that not everybody was, you know, in the same situation.
Did everyone get along on the show?
Yeah, we all got along professionally. I mean, we all did our acting. And I guess Tina was, you know, she wasn't too happy with the show because, like, in the TV Guide, I guess it was 1965, she said if she wasn't on it, she wouldn't have watched it.
Oh, so you already know where I'm going with this, don't you?
I think so.
Yeah. Now, I was reading, I believe it was in USA Today, where she was not too happy with this book you had.
No, she got very upset because I said I heard her having sex in the dressing room next to mine. And I didn't think that was very bad. I just, you know, it kind of struck me funny at lunch hour that I pounded on the wall and nothing happened. I mean, I couldn't shut it down. The noise was so loud and... But she got very upset, but I think now she's kind of taken with a sense of humor. I hope she is.
Did she actually think that she had top billing when she first got that job?
Yeah, they had told her that in New York. They had said to her that she's the star of the show. My problem is if you get fourth billing, wouldn't that be a clue?
Going on to Alan Hale,
mm-hmm.
I understand that he was also very, very loyal to the program.
Oh, yeah. He was hilarious. I mean, we do personal appearances together for, I guess, until he passed away. It was so much fun with him because he loved being the skipper and he loved the little kids, you know.
I'd sign autographs behind him, you know, and kid would come up and he'd say, what's your name? And he'd say, Billy. And he'd write Billy. And he'd say, do you have a brother, Billy? And he'd say, oh, yeah, and a sister, Billy. And meanwhile, I'm signing the autograph pictures. I got a whole stack ready to go by the time he got through with the one kid. But he was the sweetest man, really was.
Now, I heard a story that he actually broke his arm
at
the end of the second season and didn't tell anybody?
No, we had three more shows to do, and we were on the third one. We had two more before we were going to break. And he fell out of a tree, and he broke his wrist. And I saw the ace bandage on it, you know, the next week, and I said, what happened to your wrist? And he said, oh, a little sprain, nothing wrong with it. And it wasn't a year later that, you know, I found out that he did the two episodes, two more weeks of work, and then went and got it set. Because he just didn't want to shut it down, you know, and everybody, you know, missed their vacation. And he said, he was the sweetest man.
That was part of an interview with actor Bob Denver from June of 1994. He referred to Alan Hale Jr. as the sweetest man, but I can truly say that so was Bob Denver. I had the pleasure and honor to work with him as the host of a special night to Sherwood Schwartz at Montreal's Just for Laughs. In both cases, you couldn't meet nicer, sweeter men. In May of 2005, Denver underwent quadruple heart bypass surgery and was subsequently diagnosed with throat cancer. The cancer and pneumonia claimed his life on September 2nd, 2005. You can hear the full hour-long interview with Bob on my website at thestufffile.com. Click on Celebrity Audio Files and you'll find the interview with Bob and also interviews with others. They're all listed in alphabetical order and you can play them right off the page.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones and this is Let's Be Fair. Newspapers across the country are making a lot of moms and dads proud these days as they print stories about the best and brightest students graduating from high school. I'm always impressed when I read about how much these top students have accomplished and what they plan to study in college. It's still common to see that many of these high-achieving students plan to become doctors. Just like past generations of students who decided to enter the world of medicine, these young people will face many challenges, but one is fairly new. The New England Journal of Medicine has reported that, sadly, the majority of all doctors today will be sued sometime in their career. It didn't used to be this way. Let's be fair. As our nation ages and the need for doctors increases, we need to encourage young medical students. One way to do that is to make sure that our justice system not only protects patients from bad doctors, but that it protects good doctors from bad lawsuits. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And Stuart Nauman is indeed here once again. Hello, sir.
Hey, Peter. How would you like to go ding, ding, ding?
Let me see. Are you trick-or-treating on NBC Row again?
Yes, I am. Yeah, the Peacock Network strikes again. You know, if you were an avid TV viewer, Peter, during the 80s and 90s, most nights, especially Thursday...
Well, let's be honest. When was I not an avid TV viewer?
Okay, but, you know, I know you were for all your life, for most of it, but especially in the 80s and 90s, let's zero in on that period. You know, you had your set tuned to NBC. Now, this was the era of must-see TV when the Peacock Network experienced some of its greatest critical and commercial successes with a lineup of comedies and dramas that have an enduring quality with viewers, like Seinfeld, Law & Order, ER, Friends, The Cosby Show, Frasier, Will & Grace, amongst others. Now, and they average about 40 million viewers a week with these shows, compared to these days when a show is regarded a success if it gets about 20 million viewers.
Shows today need only 10 to be a success.
See, it's getting even lower. I mean,
yeah.
Wow, things have changed. Now, this was indeed the last great era of commercial network television programming, and the man who engineered it all was Warren Littlefield. Served as president of NBC's entertainment division for most of that period, and he was certainly proud of ushering this NBC television network through its most successful period of broadcasting, and he recalls it with great detail and insight in his book, Top of the Rock. Now, perhaps the main argument that Littlefield emphasizes in the book is that one of the main reasons NBC TV enjoyed so much success during the 80s and 90s was he had complete faith in the people, especially the actors and writers, who developed and created these memorable TV shows. Now, Littlefield could have done the obvious with this book and told the story of the must-see TV era from his own point of view, but he's done his share of telling the story. To his credit, he gives the floor to the group of showrunners, network executives, writers, directors, and actors to help him recount the background stories of these shows. And the end result is a well-rounded portrait told from every angle of how a major television network operation goes. Now, there's also, you have your share, you know, stories from the boardrooms of 30 Rock and Burbank to the writer's room to the studios, which provides everything from insights to how a TV show is developed to just plain interesting bits of trivia. Like, for example, at the time when Kelsey Grammer auditioned for and later got the part of Dr. Fraser Crane on Cheers, he was a struggling actor in New York and he was living in his car that he parked on the Paramount Studios lot. He wanted to, you know, portray the cultured, gregarious psychologist for 20 years. Now, Friends, the original title for Friends was Six of One. Or NBC was so desperate to have Jerry Seinfeld keep his mega-successful sitcom for a 10th and final season in 1998-99. And they were so desperate, the network, that they offered Seinfeld a contract for 22 episodes at $5 million per episode for a grand total of $110 million. Seinfeld refused the offer and ended the series run after the 97-98 season. And Top of the Rock, is a fascinating, encompassing look at the final glory days of network television programming that was once the domain of ABC, CBS, and of course NBC, from all the players who made this network TV swan song possible, from its night of, what was known as Night of Best, to must-see TV.
Now, I know you initially talked about the fact that Warren Littlefield is the person who created all this and made this what it is, and I think Warren Littlefield is pretty close to genius.
Yeah.
But I'm not about to crown him, as much as he's done so much to bring NBC to where it was in its heyday of the 80s and 90s, I'm not about to give him the crown. I still give that to the late Brandon Tartikoff.
Yeah, I have to agree. I mean, you know, Brandon Tartikoff was a major source of inspiration for Warren Littlefield. And I think, and I know Warren gives Brandon a lot of credit in this book. And like I said, Warren is not doesn't use a very self-serving tone in his book. He shares the success, you know, in this book with the other people who made it all possible, you know, with him at the helm. So he's not sort of like put himself on a pedestal with this book.
Excellent.
And he does give Tartikoff a lot of credit.
Good, good. So the book is...
It's called The Top of the Rock by Warren Littlefield. It's published by Doubleday, and you can get it for $33.
And if there are people out there who want to read other books in a similar vein dealing with, say, television or maybe even NBC, do you have a suggestion or two?
Well, I do have one, not NBC, but another network, Tiffany Network, the CBS. 1975 journalist Robert Metz wrote an excellent book called CBS Reflections in a Bloodshot Eye, and it gave a first look at, you know, what really went on in the Tiffany Network, which, you know, for many, many years dominated television broadcasting and also radio as well. And it gives a very warts and all look at this network, you know, how Paley ran it and some of the controversies that the network experienced. And also, especially how Jim Aubrey, the Smiling Cobra, almost wrecked it. And this book was, it was published in 1975. I read it in 1976 when it came out paperback, and it was like the first serious TV book I ever read, and I loved it. In fact, I liked it so much, I saw a secondhand bookstore last year, the original hardcover edition, and I bought it. It's still a great book.
I read the original hardcover. I still have the original hardcover. That is a great book. I concur.
Oh, yes, certainly. One of the best.
Anyway, Warren Littlefield's book once again is?
Top of the Rock. It's published by Doubleday. It's $33.
Excellent. And if people want to get in contact with you, find out other things that you do, how you keep busy through the rest of your day, how can you do that?
Well, you can read me in the West End Times every week, or if you can get yourself a paper copy, you can see it online every week, www.westendtimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
You're welcome, Peter. And this has been an NBC television program. No, it hasn't been.
Another edition of Book Banter with Stuart Nolman here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're almost at a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. Just a few more stories to share with you, and of course, an idiot of the day. In Portland, Oregon, police arrested 50-year-old Kola J. McGrath for what you might call baggage issues. Not the emotional kind, actual baggage issues. McGrath was arrested for trespassing after workers at her boyfriend's downtown Portland apartment complex discovered the man was sneaking her into the building by hiding her in a large rolling suitcase. This is problematic because McGrath had been banned from the building last year after she broke a fire extinguisher case during an argument with another tenant. It was fairly easy to hide her in the case as she's only 5'6" tall and weighs just 96 pounds. Police were notified when a caller reported a man had kidnapped a woman, placed her in a pink suitcase, and taken her into an apartment building. Officers then searched 52-year-old Curtis T. Lowe's apartment and found McGrath hiding in the closet. You know, the lengths some people will go for love. Then again, the fact that she can squeeze into a suitcase means she's flexible. Maybe that's the attraction. Anyway, moving right along, here's a quote from a police officer. It looked like he was making some sort of lamp out of the shell. That's according to Delaware Township, Pennsylvania patrolman Mark Cobner, after responding to see what happened in the garage of John Grimm III, who was 73. He was drilling into one of them. But the shell, one of two described as a small anti-aircraft military shell, probably of World War II vintage, was live, and it didn't react well to a power drill. It went off, Cobner said, adding that Grimm had them for a long time, probably more than 40 years. Grimm was hospitalized in critical condition with shrapnel wounds. The good news is the lamp was very bright. The bad news is it burned out in a millisecond. You know, you rarely see happy endings in a story with a guy named Grimm. And a Radio Shack store in Chicago, Illinois, was robbed by a man who tied up the clerks and got away with $17,000 worth of merchandise. Police had few leads until they got a list of the stolen items. It included a GPS tracking device, so investigators simply activated the device remotely, went to the indicated location, and arrested Raymond Jefferson, age 20, within 2 hours of the crime. And authorities will know exactly what his location will be for the next 5 to 9 years. You know, I almost made this guy the idiot of the day, but I did not. Because this is the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
After being pulled over in Bradenton, Florida by police for alleged reckless driving, 52-year-old Stephen Lawrence Panich refused to take a breathalyzer exam, telling deputies all his friends said never do it. Too bad they didn't tell him to never freely admit to drinking too many beers either. As the deputy approached Panich, who had a strong odor of booze on his breath and bloodshot eyes, he reportedly told the deputy that he had downed several beers and some wings at Hooters before going to a bar for a couple more beers. But after failing field sobriety tests, Panich declined to take a breath test, citing that sage advice from his friends. Didn't really matter. Given his testimony, they charged him with DUI anyway. Now, why would someone refuse to take a breathalyzer test, but then admit to the heavy amount of drinking they've done? One reason, and one reason only, he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0149. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information on links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0149. You can email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Let me leave you with these words of wisdom. Never, ever juggle ice picks while standing on your waterbed.